Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Hey guys, it's Nerdist Podcast, episode number 248. I'm recording on my crappy headphone mic down here in Orlando, Florida, because I'm at Star Wars Celebration. It's been amazing. I met Warwick Davis today. Huh? Right? Flitwick, Willow, Wicket. Come on. He was amazing. And also, I think I might be getting a little George Lucas interview action this weekend, too. Star Wars Celebration has been absolutely amazing. The cosplay is great. The people are super awesome. The model buildings, there's a giant Rancor monster here. There's a whole, like, tattoo section. I thought about it for half a second, but it's not going to happen. But Star Wars Celebration has been great. So thank you so much to Lucasfilm and to ReadPop for having us down this year. We're covering a bunch of stuff on StarWars.com from Nerdist. And then Saturday, I'm going to the Doctor Who premiere screening that I'm hosting in New York with Matt Smith and Karen Gillan, which means that Saturday, September 1st, is the season premiere of the next series of Doctor Who. They sprung it on us this time. We didn't know when the date was going to be, and they're like, oh, it's in a week and a half. So this is happening. So we've decided to do on the Nerdist channel, and I'm proud to announce a Doctor Who weekend starting Friday, August 31st. We are going to run All-Star Celebrity Bowling, Team Nerdist versus Team Doctor Who, recorded at San Diego Comic-Con. It was myself, Will Wheaton, Alex Albrecht, and Chloe Dykstra versus Team Doctor Who, Matt Smith, Karen Gillan, Arthur Darvill, and Stephen Moffat. This episode is so much freaking fun, and we were going to hold it till October 15th when the new season of All-Star Bowling runs, but we're like, screw it. It's Doctor Who premiere weekend. Let's do it now. So all programming next weekend is Doctor Who themed. So All-Star Bowling with Doctor Who, Friday, August 31st, and then Saturday, September 1st, a new show called Dork Fork, which is our kind of nerdy cooking show with Andy and Harrison, and special guest is going to be Alton Brown. So they're going to be making Doctor Who themed treats, so you can watch the premiere and cook up some Doctor Who themed treats. And then following the premiere of Doctor Who Saturday night is we're going to put up the Q&A from the thing that I'm going to New York to host with Matt and Karen. Then Sunday, September 2nd, we're bringing back Just Cause, a cosplay show hosted by Chloe Dykstra from Gallifrey One. So, huge, huge, huge Doctor Who happenings on the Nerdist channel. Subscribe, go there, youtube.com/Nerdist for our Doctor Who weekend. And then stay subscribed. Don't go there and then unsubscribe after that. I'd like to thank Audible.com for supporting the Nerdist podcast this episode. Audible.com is audiobooks, any book you can possibly think of. If you go to audible.com/Nerdist, you'll get a free audiobook download. You can listen wherever you want, whenever you want. I like audiobooks better in a lot of cases because the authors read them, and it just kind of gives you a perspective of what they were thinking when they wrote. Now I'm just explaining to you how audiobooks work, and you're not a moron, so I'm going to stop doing that. But I really recommend Bossy Pants because Tina Fey reads it, and it is mind-blowingly good. Over 100,000 titles to choose from. Every genre. Audible has it covered. Audible.com/Nerdist for your free audiobook download. And now this episode of the Nerdist Podcast is Joel Hodgson. When I talk about how Will Wheaton and I are roommates, I probably say it way too much, but it's true, and it was a large part of my youth. And we discovered Mystery Science Theater together, and that was our Friday night ritual when that show first started airing. That show changed me comedically. It showed me that you didn't have to play to every audience in the world to write brilliant comedy, that you just had to be funny, and then the right audiences would find you. So, huge inspiration. I love Joel Hodgson. I worked with him on my very first job in the 1900s. I'll just leave it at that. And I love that guy. So, here we go. The Nerds Podcast. We all geeked out on this super hard. The Nerds Podcast, number 248, with Joel Hodgson. Up and Gangnam Style. Hey, sexy lady.
I don't know how it goes.
Up and Gangnam Style.
I can't do it.
That's not very Gangnam Style of you over there.
Come on.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
So it could be really great.
You're fried from traveling? Joel, this better be the best appearance on an audio form of media that you've ever been in your life.
What time is it on the big 101?
Your voice sounds the exact same frazzled from traveling than it does every other time I've heard you talk.
Okay, good. That's what I'm going for.
We're
going
to go to traffic with Joel Hodgson.
Listen, it's the big one.
What?
It's the big one. What does that mean?
Why did we go to traffic to announce the earthquake that's going to destroy the state?
I'm into earthquakes now, guys. This earthquake wasn't even here. It's another place. It was a big
just
one.
Just turned into Buffalo Bill.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Took a turn.
I can't help it.
Man, I just ended up watching... like a Howdy Doody online just like yesterday. It's really late, and I don't know even how I ended up watching it.
Was it like a kinescope one that's like sort of you can tell?
No,
the
it was
shot
the last
TV.
One, so it was color, It was like I'm trying to think. Oh, it was Clarabelle Talked.
Okay,
that's the big reveal
at the end,
the big ending, mm-hmm. and I was just sitting there going like what's the fascination? Like why?
What did Clarabelle say?
I don't know.
Daddy,
I'm so
just
lonely.
Like Lisa Simpson.
No, that was Maggie.
Yeah, I know. I said dad. She said daddy.
No, yeah.
Then she said dad.
You said Lisa.
Oh, I meant, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you know just Maggie, which we is Elizabeth,
let's
Elizabeth
start,
Taylor's
let's
voice.
Start over.
Okay.
Joel's really fried right now, guys. Yeah.
So, traffic? Fuck, I forgot where we were. Howdy Doody to me, like, I tried to watch it.
Well,
whoa, we got a fleet.
We're high above the city.
Eagle going by.
Nerdist Radio, we've got three helicopters covering traffic. That's three helicopters covering traffic and silent.
And you can do your internal voice like Carlin used to do, like, ooh, that's weird. Yeah. When you've got a microphone. What's that guy doing?
Which Gaffigan does now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's weird.
I don't think this is going well at all.
That way? Oh.
And then he started doing another voice to argue with that voice. That lady won't shut up.
Yeah.
Why they gotta talk in that voice?
So Joel Hodgson, let's just go back a ways. And first of all, even before Mystery Science Theater, I remember you going on SNL when actually they had stand up sets.
Yeah.
On SNL,
yeah,
and you used to do all the Agent J stuff.
It was a dark time for SNL because their sketches weren't funny enough. They had to like boost them by bringing in like actual comics to do stuff.
Who was the cast? I can't remember who the cast was at that time.
Well, I think Eddie Murphy was just like heading out the door. Julie Louise Dreyfus and... I can't really. Oh, Joe Piscopo is there.
Oh, yes. Right. That was just before. That was before. That was like right before.
Say no more, Joel.
That was right that before was they overhauled and did. I think that was right before like Billy Crystal, Christopher Guest, Harry Shearer.
Right.
It was like Stevenson.
Randy Quaid.
It was like a hard
Randy Quaid, Denny Dillon.
But I was so grateful to get to do it, and it was the only TV show I ever did that really was like you're doing. It's like. It's like doing the play in high school. There's a huge party afterwards. So you actually like, I'm on TV, and then we go into the city, and there's a huge party somewhere. So it was actually kind of a fulfillment. Whereas like doing Letterman was like, everybody leaves right away.
Because you know? Like, they got to be there.
Letterman hits a button and he just drops out from his desk.
Go get pizza.
Yeah.
Like, what's going to happen after Letterman? No, everybody disappears.
So it felt like going, doing SNL like felt like a big showbiz kind
of
moment.
It really was. It really fulfilled all my expectations. And it's live, so everybody's watching it at the same time. Like, I went out to eat afterwards, and the people in the bar was like, thumbs up. We saw you on SNL, man.
Wow.
It was
wow.
great. So it's so immediate.
Was it by day, mild-mannered comedian, by night, Agent J?
It was Agent was the Agent J.
And it was all the contraptions that just looked like, I don't remember exactly what they were, but it was something like boombox, and then it turns into like a rifle. Yeah.
And that's an old toy from the 60s from Mattel called Zero M. It was a line of toys, and they were awesome. It was a camera that turned into a pistol. It was a radio that turned into a rifle.
Cold War.
Did you just say Cold War?
Yeah, that's Cold War era shit.
Like, just pronounce
Cold War. Guys, when the fucking Ruskies attack, all our appliances got to turn into guns.
We're talking about the Cold War. There was even a movie camera that became like a Tommy gun.
Yeah.
And there was
it shoots both ways.
Jackknife that then turned back into like a can opener. That wasn't very popular. But the things that turned into weapons, they were fantastic. So when I was doing my act, I'd occasionally find those. Like, I'd go to the Goodwill and find stuff, and that's how I kind of built my act. And I'd find them, and I'd go, I have to do something. These are so awesome. It's like a magician built these tricks.
Yeah.
Or these toys.
And did you just do the show once, or did you do it a couple times?
I did a bunch of times. Yeah. I did it four times, like, that year.
I really miss that element. I really miss that element from that show. I mean, they don't need it now. They have so many cast members fighting for...
They started off that way, though. And they, you know, they had Kaufman on, and they had Carlin.
It was really more of a variety show in the beginning. And now,
the pilot for it, have you seen the pilot for SNL?
No.
It's weird. It's like, it really is like a 70s variety show where Paul Simon's like introducing... the next song, here's a song I wish I'd written.
And Carlin hosted, right? Carlin hosted
was
the first show.
One, yeah, but
they didn't want him wearing jeans.
But I think Paul Simon did. It was like really weird, and then they hardly had the not ready for primetime players at all. Like, they did like one sketch. So even then, they didn't. It wasn't like super clear.
Yeah, I remember watching like some of the early episodes of that show. It's not that they're unwatchable. They're just finding it, whatever it is. And it's definitely, it's like the sketches they're doing and what the audience is watching. There's a little bit of a disconnect. I just remember one where it was like, they're all high school kids and they're like, Sally gave me VD or whatever it is. But there wasn't really, I don't remember there being a payoff. And then the audience just kind of, it almost just felt more like weird performance art that was a little bit punk and antithetical to the rest of television comedy at the time.
And it was 70s television, so everyone just looked sweaty.
Everyone looked sweaty, and it looked dirty. 70s television always looked like it had just gotten fucked.
Yeah, exactly.
It just always had that look.
Yeah, it's like you come back from commercial, and everyone's like...
Oh my God! Can you tell? Is my hair
good?
Is my mash up? So, how did you? First of all, how did you? Did you? You're from Minnesota,
right?
Right. And so, did you?
Did you just say A?
But yeah, I accidentally did.
Yeah. It checks out. Story checks out.
How was Minnesota's
Christ Day? That's how you do it. Christ Day.
Because Minneapolis has an amazing stand-up scene now. Was it always that way?
Yeah, it was. It was great, and I don't know how it happened. I was just so lucky to be there. And at one time, there was this guy, Scott Hansen, who was like the don of comedy in Minneapolis. And he just was really ambitious, and he had so many rooms. Like, at one time, supposedly had more seats for comedy than like New York City.
Oh, wow.
Like just tons of rooms. And so it was great, and the audiences are... they're super nice. They're like, appreciative.
It's a great place to do comedy.
They love it. They're just like super encouraging. And I'm sure that just doing stand up there and Mystery Science Theater there was like I mean, part of it was they're just so, like, open. Like, they didn't feel like they had to judge it. Like, oh, it's creative. Let it live.
Yeah. Let it live.
Was Minneapolis, like, a hippie city? Like, was there that element
of
just...
Yeah, there's something about it. That, and I don't know how it happened, but there is definitely this bohemian element to it. It's really amazing. And it's just the people there... really great. And
the music there is just, yeah, it's just insane, the amount of creativity that
I
comes
think
out of
too,
it.
And you know, it, again, it's part of it is it was so cold and you really had to, like, you were really like had to woodshed, you know, like when you're like, if you're learning to do music or if you're doing comedy or whatever, you really had time to like kind of think about it.
Yeah.
In a lot of quiet moments to like kind of ponder what you were going to do. And then when the weather got good, it got crazy. It was like bacchanalian and people were just go nuts. So it something about it, I don't know, but I wonder if I would have lived somewhere else if it would have ended up the way it did, you know?
It's when you go there, it's, you know, the times that I've been there, like in the summer, you know, cities like Milwaukee and in Wisconsin, obviously in Wisconsin, Milwaukee and Minneapolis, you go to these cities and they're really, there's a lot of culture and there's a lot of theater and everyone's really nice and it's really beautiful and they've taken all the old factories and made them really cool, like modern buildings. And you go, oh my God, I could totally see living here. And then you remember that for 10 months out of the year, whatever, it's unbearable. Like, just like I sheet.
Well, the Northwest, I think, is a lot like that too, where it's like, you know, everyone's inside because it's raining so much of the time and they're just, you know, like, that's why so much music is there. There's just guys in their apartments and in their practice spaces just tooling around.
Yeah.
And then, like, when it gets better, everyone's just playing shows the entire time.
Yeah. See, that's why LA is so shallow, because you're just outside all the time because the weather's so nice. You're not forced to be introspective. Because you're just in...
What about our cars, man?
We are inside our cars a lot.
Yeah, just like my favorite soliloquy from the movie Crash.
Do you have a favorite anything from the movie Crash?
We just crash into each other just so we can feel something.
Hey, Roseanne Arquette, I'm going to fuck your leg wound.
Oh, wrong Crash.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking about the more pretentious Crash. Not
I was talking about the David Cronenberg Crash.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
This is another segment we like to call, which Crash are we talking about?
I was thinking of Flash.
You were thinking of Flash. And now I was thinking of Flash.
Yeah.
He'll fuck all our leg wounds. Dun, 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 dun,
I was thinking of the Dave Matthews album, Crash.
I was trying to explain to someone the other day about they'd never seen Flash Gordon. I'm like, you have to watch it again because it's clear that they were trying to do a comic booky sort of a thing. But it just look. I mean, it's just like, you know, little people in garbage bags, kind of for you know
Isn't
what
that
I mean.
The name of your next book,
Little People in Garbage Bags. Yeah.
Forward by Peter Dinklage.
Oh, come on. I mean, seriously.
Sorry.
And then, which leads me to the next point is people are probably always like, "Hey, how come you should do this movie? You should do that movie, Joel. Oh, yeah. You should do Flash Gordon."
Yeah, all the time.
Are you ever? Do you ever go, "Hey, that's actually a good idea"? You're like, "Nah."
Man, I still haven't figured out like an elegant answer like to what to say to people. It's
no.
I try to like when right. I mean, the problem is I do a lot of interviews and they always ask, "Okay, what movie do you really want
that you've never had
on? Really, really want to do?" And there's like a formula. You just go, "Oh, let's see, what's the big crap movie? Oh, it's John Carter of Mars, everyone. That's the one."
One I've been waiting this whole time.
Actually, I have to say, I kind of like that movie, but that's the formula. Is you give them the agreed upon bad movie of the time.
Yeah.
And if it's a writer,
you should just say like, "Precious," and then they'll never ask you again. Just like pick an Oscar.
Yeah. American History X. I really wish I could tackle that one.
Just want to get in there.
Get quiet. It all goes bad.
Schindler's List. I'm sorry.
Dance in the Dark.
You know what I do? I try to go. I try to school them a little bit and go, "Oh, it's like." It's like when you're refurbishing a house and you got to find a house with good bones. And so we don't really dream shop for movies. We get a movie, look at it, walk around in it and say, "Does this look like it'll work?" And
yeah.
So it's really true, and it's just not an interesting answer, but they always ask. And also, where do you get your movies?
Oh, right.
It's always what they
ask. And where do you get your ideas from?
Yeah. Exactly. How does that work exactly?
Did the robots construct themselves?
How you funny?
I think that would be neat to be funny.
That just seems like it'd be a gosh darn good time being funny.
Are you Hulhauser all of a sudden?
Golly!
What you guys did with that, just starting in public access, it was very, the spirit of it was years ahead of its time. It's very much digital culture, YouTube generation, like, hey, we're just going to make this thing that we think is fun just because.
Well, yeah, I mean, actually it was UHF, VHS.
No, oh, for some reason I thought it was public access.
No, it's UHF. Yeah, it's UHF, but it's kind of the same thing.
Old-timey public access.
Yeah, it really was.
Because it's local TV.
Public access for profit.
Yeah. It was private access.
There was a second dial you had to tune in.
Channel like 31.
Exactly, to get a UHF channel. And, you know, it was kind of in the air, I think. I think, it happened with music prior to that. Like, music is kind of, you know, the beginning of it, and it's like, to me, that you'd see people doing that, talking about that. Oh, we recorded this in our home.
Yeah,
we recorded this in a trailer. So people were starting to do that, and so it was all laying itself out. Like, oh yeah, you can make TV from this, and if it's a good enough idea, it might work. And so I think that was kind of in the back of my mind, and I got approached by Jim Mallon, who's the guy who ran the channel, the little UHF channel. And I had this idea, and he wanted to do like a stand-up, it was like a gong show with stand-ups.
Okay.
And so he kind of started the conversation by saying, you know, what do you know about the comedy scene, and, what do you think of this? And I said, it's okay, and, I'll help you if I can, but you should just talk to this guy. And it just didn't seem that interesting. It was pretty pedestrian, I thought, and I didn't really want to get involved with it. But then I went home and thought about it, and I started going, maybe I could pitch him this idea, this movie, idea. And at the time, I think when I started it, it was like... it was more like the Omega Man, the Charlton Heston Omega Man, where he's like in that movie theater watching Woodstock. Look at all the people. and I kind of remember that, and I had a drawing of a robot. There was this Rex the robot who'd be sitting with the guy, and it was supposed to be this apocalyptic show where this guy's, everybody's gone, and he's in the movie theater watching a movie.
Slowly
turns
going
out,
insane.
Not that funny of a premise at the apocalypse.
And the next episode, he's watching it again. It's the only one left.
So I kind of just took the robot idea, and I remember this movie I always liked called Silent Running.
Of course.
With Bruce Dern.
Yeah.
And I always loved that. It was just like Douglas Trumbull made that movie, and it was like, it was really cool. It was like a hippie... in
a hippie space movie.
And it was very environmental, and
they're transferring the trees, right?
Right. It's like the world has killed all the trees, and there's these geodesic domes with forests in them, and they've got to fly him around in space until the world heals itself or something, and he loses his mind, but along the way, he has this relationship with these three robots, this Huey, Dewey, and Louie. That's what he names them, and so I just kind of went with that. Kind of like, oh, that'll work. It's a guy in space. He's got robots, and he's watching movies. So that was kind of the pilot. Was that? And I think it more was like a pirate radio station. It was more like he's up there and broadcasting, trying to reach people. And after we did the pilot, and I think we did one or two shows, and Jim. Mallon like canvassed some people and said, what do you think of this? And someone said, it needs like a theme song. You need to explain it. It's a little too weird. And I wouldn't have gotten to that because it's just too like average, I think, too obvious. And I think I wanted people to wade into my world and and turn out to be the perfect thing, you know. And so Josh and I wrote the theme song, and that's where we got to just all the things like, you know, the notion that he can't control the movies, that these bosses shot him into space and are doing this. Those things dropped in at that point, you know. Prior to that, it was the robots and a movie and a guy in space, but that really kind of, within 3 weeks, we had kind of flushed it out.
Because of writing the theme song for it is where you came up with more of the ideas?
Oh, yeah.
That's an interesting idea.
The actual arc of, like, and also saying, to me, that line about repeat to yourself, it's just a show, I should really just relax, like, fixed everything. And also, you know, we didn't have to worry about it. And also, you didn't have to...
if you're wondering how he eats and breathes and other science facts...
Yeah, it's just a show, I should really just relax.
Yeah. And it like... Yeah, but how does he eat and breathe?
Yeah.
You couldn't do that.
Yeah, and so, and also it kind of put a... It kind of fixed everything. It kept us from thinking about it too much and just like, oh, come on, it just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Just get to the meat of it.
So, yeah, so that really, like, it was funny, but that really corrected a lot of those things, and especially the Mads and that, the whole, just how deliberate it is. We're mad scientists. We're showing you movies. It's against your will. You can't stop them. And that's it.
Well, so. I remember the very first, it was a very, very, very important time for me. I was exactly the right age. I was like 19 years old. I was at UCLA, and like that previous summer, I had also discovered Ren and Stimpy. And so I'm just kind of gelling on that and Liquid Television and Spike and Mike, and then flipping around Comedy Central. It was either on at 10 or midnight. I can't remember, on a Friday night, but it was like Friday night. I was alone because that happened a lot. And I'm flipping channels and I stumble across it and I see you in the jumpsuit and the robots and you're making a craft of something or other. And then you're talking about mucilage. Mucilage, the bonding, like a bonding agent. And Crow says, "Hey kids, mucilage tastes like sweet honey." And I remember that. And you're like, "Don't tell them that. Stop it." Like, that was the first. I was like, "What the fuck is this?" And then discovering that you then go into a movie, and then, like, it's one of those shows where the first second you see it, the silhouettes and the movie, and you're like, "Oh my God, of course."
Yeah.
Why hasn't anyone? Of course. And then from then on, was hooked. And, you know, my roommate Will and I watched that every Friday. We'd get together and watch that. And then the marathon started and became a daily show and the popularity. And to this day, because we have friends who do the same kind of setup. But, you know, Matt does a Star Trek where he makes fun of Star Trek episodes. And Doug Benson does Movie Interruption. And right. But still, when you explain shows to people that revolve around that, you go, "Well, they're just Mystery Science Theatering Star Trek episodes." Yeah. Like, you own that. I mean, maybe not financially, but you own it, you know, philosophically.
Thank you.
Joel. Clean it. Yeah.
Wow.
And
thanks. Yeah, it was just, you know, it was kind of just, it's very peculiar. There's a couple of things that helped me get to it. I remember in college, a roommate of mine had this book, The Golden Turkey Awards. Have you ever seen that?
Oh, yeah. I've seen that.
And it was like, I remember reading it. It's fascinating, just like going, oh. And in Minneapolis, you could go to the university and they'd be playing like The Terror of Tiny Town. And it was kind of like the golden age of like midnight movies and art house cinema with.
Like ironic viewing of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like just the beginning of. Like Rocky Horror, and it was just kind of happening, and it wasn't available on TV. And I remember sitting there reading it going, why isn't anybody making a show with this stuff? Like, what? Why not? That would be awesome.
Yeah.
And so that book and the Psychotronic Film Guide was out, which was also a very similar book, which was, again, ironic. Movies that you got to watch because you can't believe how bad they are or great they are. So that was at play too, and the other thing was in high school, I kind of thought of it when I was at this friend's house and we were like working on the float for homecoming at his house, right? Folding like the flowers, the paper things, you stuff in chicken wire, and And this is like the Elton John, like Goodbye Yellow Brick Road album was like really huge, and they were listening to it. And I remember looking at the cover, and there's this illustration of these silhouettes watching a movie, and I just kind of was going, yeah, that would be like a cool show if you ran a movie and had people saying stuff. It seems fairly easy, you know, to do.
But it's actually not easy to do, which, you know, like to do that.
But when you're in high school,
piece
it together.
I mean, it might be easy. It might be easy for you, but just you know, over the years, I've tried it, and obviously, you know, my ex-girlfriend did some of the riff tracks stuff, and it just when you're a consumer of it, you're like, oh, this is seamless, and you're just making jokes, but your home run rate in jokes per minute was extraordinarily high. And it's fucking hard. Like, I would watch Janet go back and forth and back and forth. And, like, you watch for 5 seconds at a time and be like, oh, okay, scribble notes and then rewind and then scribble notes and then play, you know. I mean, I'm sure it got easier maybe in the end, but it watching that happen is like, this is a grueling process.
Yeah, I mean, it can be. I mean, the thing that we were so lucky about was we really got to grow into it, because it's like when we started, it was like I just kind of thought, oh, man, it's just like you'll say something every now and then and a robot will go get popcorn. You know, it was like my idea was just, oh, it's companions who are watching the show with you and saying stuff.
Yeah.
And so in the pilot, there's like two jokes, you know. It's like most of it is to set up the premise. We were just kind of showing the host segments, and then we'd go through the doors, and then we went into the theater, and we were either coming in at the very beginning of a clip or leaving, and there's like just two jokes to signify, oh, you say stuff in the movie segment. And to me, like in the course of doing the 22 shows on UHF, it was like I kind of didn't know how much we could do. Like, I kept thinking, the viewer can't multitask. It's too many jokes. It'll destroy itself. And really, it wasn't until we kind of made a sell tape at the end of it to go to Comedy Channel to sell it to them. And we cut together like a really all our funny jokes. And I go, oh, this is what it has to be. This is what it should be the whole time. But it wasn't really ever clear. So we had all this like, a long, you know, really long time to like kind of wade into it, walk through it and learn it. And we didn't know that it would be what you saw, which was just, it's just always, we're just, all the pistons are firing and we've got jokes all along the way. It wasn't clear at all that, to me or anybody, because we weren't doing, if you look at any of the KTMA episodes, it's really sparse and, you know, it's not there. And we didn't write anything then. It was all improvised, and we're just saying stuff. And
so you pretty much had 22 episodes to make a pilot.
You're exactly right. Yeah. And if we would have done it the way you usually do it, it never would have happened. If I would have had to like pitch
an
idea and go and then bring it to fruition in the course of like 6 weeks or 8 weeks or 6 months, that just wouldn't have happened. So that's another thing we were super lucky, is we just got to practice on TV.
Yeah.
You know, figure it out.
Did you keep up stand-up regularly during that time, or did you take a backseat?
I can't quite remember. I think I deliberately quit, like, stand-up. I did, like, 3 years of stand-up, and then I was out here, and I quit and moved back to Minneapolis, and I didn't really know what I was going to do. I did a couple of different things. I wasn't doing it for like a year or two, and I think it was only after we did like the first like KTMA shows, and there was like this kind of period where we were waiting for the show to get sold, that I started doing another stand-up again, and it was just because I was kind of getting back into it.
You said something on one of the, after the show became popular, and then, you know, and all through college, I had a Mystery Science Theater decal on the back of my car, which I think is still in storage somewhere. Like that thing followed me for so many moves. Cause I don't remember how I may have written a fan letter or something and gotten it back in the mail. The fan club. Yeah. I think I joined the fan club, and I think that's what I got in the mail. Yeah. The Misties.
Is the PO Box still in existence?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think
it still runs with all like the Netflix versions of it. It still shows up.
I can't believe that.
There's some poor guy in Minnesota's like, hey, what is all this shit?
I think the people who run the satellite website, like the Mystery Science Theater website, I believe they are in charge of it.
Oh, it could be.
That'd be nice.
Yeah.
But you said, you know, when the show became popular and then, you know, then there became shows about the show and just, you know, everyone wanted to figure out. Because you couldn't pitch a show like that to network television. You go, well, it's a guy and a couple robots and they're just going to watch an entire movie. Wait, so you're going to cut it down? No. It's a 2-hour show. You could fuck off. Like, they just would never allow, which is so internet-y in the way that it became popular, was like, hey, traditional media, here is examples of this working. So now all you have to do is take it and put it on your platform.
Keep circulating the tapes.
But you said in an interview once, and this resonated with me, and it became one of the core philosophies to how I approach comedy, which was, you said... we never said who's going to get these jokes. We always said the right people will get these jokes. And it just, I was like, oh my God, of course. You don't have to write jokes for everyone in the world.
Yeah, I got that from, this is going to sound so stupid, but it was really weird. I read, I think when I was in college, Jackson Brown was really huge with Running on Empty,
yep.
The live studio album, which was like live from the road.
Yeah.
And I think he was at the height of his powers. And I remember reading an article about him, and they kept asking him to interpret his songs. And he just said, I'm not going to tell you, you'll get it. Seriously, just think about it. You'll get it. It was so clever to kind of make people interpret what he was doing, you know? And I think, I believe that, you know, I believe that there's not really an actual point to a joke. It's kind of like people are all kind of busy interpreting it at different speeds, and hopefully they're all kind of in the same neighborhood. But that was kind of the belief I had when I started. I think it's much more, now it's much more product-oriented, like when we do Cinematic Titanic.
Sure.
Which I gotta say, we're at the Saban Theater on Sunday night in L.A.
Excellent. Yeah, I saw the billboard. I mean, the billboard, the marquee.
Yeah,
I got my tickets.
Awesome. Nice. It's gonna be fun, and so it's much more product oriented now because we just go, well, what's the funniest thing to say? We know the audience and stuff. But when I was starting, I think I was much more open and didn't know exactly what it would be. I was fortunate that I was around a lot of, like I said earlier, a lot of bohemian people and artists where there's not really a point to... there's not a defined moment. And I think comedy is much more about, you know, the joke is the joke. But I feel like back then I was a lot more open to that and more... And so that's what allowed us to kind of, you know, go into it and look for it.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't clear. I mean, as funny as it's, as weird as it sounds, it just didn't drop on me. Like, we're going to do this show and there's going to be 800 jokes.
Right.
Per movie. It wasn't that at all. It was just, oh, there's a silhouette and they're going to say stuff and it's going to be funny and you're not going to believe what they say. But it wasn't that, the volume. That came when we actually got paid to do it, when we went to the Comedy Channel and I just said, okay, my friends are going to see this now. We have to write this.
So then, which season did you leave? Was it after two seasons?
No, I did the first 100 shows. So I did 20, the 20 at the UHF channel, or how many we did, 26, and the rest. So that must have been the first 4 seasons, maybe.
Because I'm thinking of a season. Maybe I'm thinking of it as calendar years and not seasons. But did you actually do it for 5 years, or was it 5 cycles that it was, were about 2.5 years?
Well, there was I don't exactly remember. I don't know. It's like something like must have been 4 seasons.
4. Okay.
For like 20. Well, yeah, that's right. If we made 22 shows a year, that would be about 80, and then the other 20 from UHF. So it's something like that. 4 years. For the Comedy Channel or Comedy Central.
And was the decision to just like, okay, now the show's gotten some popularity and I've done this and I kind of want to go do some other things and start some other projects?
Well, it was really, it was really weird. I'm still kind of unpacking a lot of it. I think more than anything, what had happened was this idea of doing the feature film came up, and we were really psyched about doing it as a feature film because they had done it with Star Trek: The Next Generation, yeah. Right? Like, oh, they're making movies now. They quit making the series, and now they just make a movie, and that's awesome. And we were kind of going, oh yeah, you know, that would be pretty cool. Instead of 22 good shows, we can make one great movie and then just do it every year, and it would be really cool. And I think we kind of got carried away with that. And the thing that happened was Jim Allen, my partner, he came in one day and said, well, I think I'm the logical guy to direct this movie, because he had directed another low-budget movie. And I kind of just didn't, there's just something about it. I didn't know, like, it didn't quite feel right. And the other part of the deal was, he goes, well, I'm going to produce and direct it. And then Trace, Kevin, and Joel, you're associate producers on it. So I kind of felt like it didn't reflect
right
my position as the creator of the show. And I didn't know what that would be. I didn't want to direct it. I didn't think that was what I wanted to do.
Associate producer is a crappy title, by the
way.
Yeah. Like it's a very low-end producer
title.
Yeah,
and even I knew that. So it's very peculiar, and I'm going, well, yeah, there's got to be... This just doesn't reflect, you know, the world that Mystery Science Theater is, and my participation with it, and my, you know, what I did for it. So I kind of said, you know, if you're going to do that, I really don't want to be on camera. I really don't think I should be the guy, because I just didn't think it would work. I didn't think he, I mean, really, the problem it was really an ensemble show. It was really like we did it in the room. We wrote it together. We did it on the set, and we all just kind of decided what take we'd go with. And since it was just like one shot, it wasn't really like, I mean, we all kind of directed it together.
Yeah.
And so I think the problem was kind of like, well, how do you create a template that goes into the movie industry, you know, 15 years ago, where, you know, you make that work. So I think in his own way, he was going, well, the way I'm going to protect the brand is for me to be the guy to do it. And I would have just preferred, like, oh, let's bring in a director, like a good director that will work with us, you know, and just keep everything as it is. We never, ever dreamed that, you know, after we did the movie and it failed, like someone else would pick up the show. That's unheard of.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't happen. Usually if you, oh, the show's done, we're going to make movies now. If the movie fails, you don't get to do anything else. So that was an amazing thing that it got to keep going. And they're really funny too. I really like the shows that, there's a huge Mike and Joel thing, and it's right. Like, it's kind of unfair because to me, it's like, hey, I created those shows too.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what's the difference, you know? So that's always really peculiar that happened, but it might have helped the brand too. It's kind of like Quisp and Quake, you know? And,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, it just engaged people. It's also very provocative, like who does that? Like, that guy's gone, there's another guy in there, and suddenly people are asked to make a decision who they like better or what do they prefer. And
it was odd because people were getting so upset about, like, who is this guy? It's like, haven't you been paying attention? He's been in all the bets
and also
for years.
He was like the head writer, so that was kind of cool. That I think that kind of showed that we're writers and we're performers. So it kind of like, he was promoted from within. So I think for nerds, you know, and I didn't mean to look at you.
No, please. It's fine. It's fine. I appreciate it.
But you mean the guy with the glasses wearing the Communist Colossus shirt?
Okay. Yeah. Well,
to be honest, though, I'm wearing a...
Oh, you're wearing Flynn Lives?
Flynn Lives.
And I've got my original Star Trek crew shirt on.
Yes.
Yeah. Any direction you look, Joel.
Yeah, it's nerd territory. but anyway, yeah, so... I don't know. I got kind of misty there, but what are we talking about again?
No, we were just talking about like just that you're
the end of your
that you're still sort of.
I'm still figuring it out, and it's like the more time that goes by, Like, just recently, it just dawned on me. I'm like going, I'm kind of pissed that people like have segmented the Mike and the Joel things. Like, it's really unfair to me because it's like, well, wait a minute. Like, why is that? So that's just my own personal thing where you kind of go, I get if they want to compare me to Mike as a movie riffer, I think that's totally fair. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
But it's like, they're like behaving like, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't write the theme song and I didn't build the robots.
Well,
you
it's know just what like I mean? the voice of the show didn't change, even though it was, you know, Mike Acevedo, it was this, it's like, I feel just, there's no real big, like, you know, turn in the show's quality.
No, what changed was the literal voice you hear. That's all that changed.
Yeah, the literal voice and then the theme song a little bit.
Yeah, like I started listening to those or watching them on Netflix, and it's like, man, they really make me laugh because I don't know any of the jokes. Like when I see the, like Mike and Kevin and Bill ones, it's like I just sort of laugh my ass off watching them. So it's like, it's really fun, and it's, you know, it's just as good to me.
Yeah,
you know, but yeah, it's always peculiar. Like something always bugged me about it, and I didn't know if it was like,
well, because you know, I think people are. It always happens where I think it's just the way people's brains work, where if you work with a woman, they always want to know if you're sleeping with that, if they're sleeping together. And if you work with another dude, they're always like, oh, it's a weird competition, huh? And you're like, yeah. No, it's that. I mean, he does what he does. I do what I do. Well, we're clearly different.
And even in the world of just this podcast, people tend to like people that listen to this podcast try to separate like, oh, who are you a bigger fan of, Matt or Jonah? Like either of us, it's like Chris. Everyone loves him, but like they feel they have to.
Yeah, you really just have to fight it out.
I'm not. I don't really.
Yeah. Well, no.
The people that don't like us.
But it's weird that people feel they need to. You know. Yeah.
I mean, I think in some ways it probably really helped, and you know, it just showed that the concept was worthy of rolling over a cast, and I think that's good. You know.
Well, I like Mike, and I know all the, you know, I know Kevin and Bill, and I don't really know Trace very well, but you know, but still, those original Joel episodes are just, you know, they just really, they showed me what smart comedy could be, which was really an important thing, that you didn't have to play broad, and because I think, you know, even now what people understand about the kind of niche culture that we're in is. You always just think, oh, this thing I make, everyone's got to like it. And you're like, no, really? You know, it's like the 1,000 true fans premise of like, you really just, you know, if you hit an audience that you love, you know, it's, you don't get douchebag fans, you know, who don't get what you're trying to do. And also you really connect with those people on a very communal level because you're having this shared experience. I think it's a much better way to do comedy.
Yeah. I guess it was peculiar too because we didn't really, there was like no feedback at all. I mean, we get like above ground press, like, oh, the, you know, New York Times would write a really nice review of us and kind of go, oh, this is something you should watch. This is good. And then we'd get letters. But other than that, it wasn't like.
No Twitter in 92.
Yeah, it wasn't clear like how people felt about it. So really. It really was us amusing ourselves, and we had a timetable. Like, we really had to roll over a new show every 8 days, and so we just had to keep it rolling. But
God damn it, that is an extraordinary joke output for that is fucking insane. That is insane.
And you know what else is insane is we only worked like 7 hours a day. We didn't like stay up all night. We never stayed past 5 o'clock ever.
Oh, look how cold outside. Yeah. You had to get home.
Laid back Midwest attitude.
But it was really true. We didn't, and that's what was so hard after I left and I came to Hollywood and I saw how brutal it was to be in a writing room. It was just so unpleasant.
Yeah.
And it was just like had this kind of term paper mentality. Like you just gotta be here all the time to demonstrate that you're working really hard. And I just hated it. It was just like, this is miserable.
Well, you were the very first, like celebrity. Like when I first started working at MTV, we worked on Trash together.
Right.
Do you remember Trash in 94? And I got plucked out of college to do that show. And you know, again, I know I've said this before on the podcast, but the group of writers and performers on that show which was just an MTV game show where they had tried to redo Remote Control again, which they tried to do every few years. But it was literally like the Higgins boys and Gruber and Doug Benson and Brian Posehn and Dana Gould and Cross and Odenkirk and Janine and Kindler and Kathy Griffin and just like Margaret Cho, like just this insane collection of performers. And you and Chris Henchy. And you built the gadgets, you built the devices that would destroy people's. Trashed was a show where people would bring on their personal items, and then if they didn't get enough questions right, a machine would destroy their stuff. And you built these super clever things, and you, like, I could not, I felt like I made it so hard when I got that job, and I'm like, I'm working with Joel? Are you fucking kidding me? And I tried so hard not to nerd out on you, but it was really hard not to.
Oh, that's funny. You know, I was always, it's funny, it always plagues me, like I know Chris Henchy,
yeah,
and I know I worked with him on a show, but every time I see him, I'm like gapping, like, where did we work
trashed.
Together?
Mm.
He's
MTV's
such a
trashed.
Nice guy, and he's like, you know, but yeah, it was Trashed. I didn't even remember that.
Yep.
Yeah, that was interesting, because it was a little bit like the... like being Michael Douglas in the China Syndrome, because it was people's personal effects,
yeah,
things they loved, and you had to figure out a really elegant and visual way to destroy them the first time, every time, in front of an audience of people. So everything is wrong about that.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds great in a meeting, sounds great on paper, but when you're like going, how do we wreck this clock radio so it looks awesome and nobody gets hurt? So I remember the day I left, they were using those clay pigeon launchers,
yeah,
to throw CDs,
yeah,
and it's like throwing a ninja star, yeah, when you throw a CD. It was crazy, but I'm glad nobody got hurt.
Nobody got hurt, but it was a really fun show with that, you know, most people in this world will never remember, but that group. For a lot of them, it was their first television job.
Yeah.
And it completely, you know, I have no right to feel smug because I just got cast on that show, but I just feel kind of proud, like, yeah, I worked on this thing that all these amazing people that I love that ended up becoming like all of the big comics now. And it just like seeing all of it together, yeah, in that one little cluster.
That, yeah, that is really cool thing about that time in Hollywood, like what was happening. Like on Monday, you know, I'm out for this Everything Is Festival. And on Monday, I'm going to be at CineFamily and I'm talking about TV Wheel, which is one of my favorites.
I was going to ask you about TV Wheel. I still have the pilot on VHS tape in storage.
Yeah, they aired it on Comedy Central.
What?
They aired it on Comedy Central after one of the last Comedy Central, yeah, Mystery Science Theater.
I remember when you went to shoot that, because it was a lot of the same people worked,
yeah,
on that.
Yeah.
Tom Kenny was,
yeah,
on that.
David Cross was in that.
So if you don't want to just explain the concept of TV Wheel.
Oh, yeah. It was kind of like... the premise was, I was looking at the idea of, like, how do you make TV? You know, TV gets it gets so segmented because of the way it's made. It's kind of made like a movie sometimes. You know, you shoot things out of order. You know, as a performer and as a group of performers, it's not always clear what's going on. And so I just wanted it to be more theatrical, more live. And I was kind of thinking... a TV is a window, right? It's in your room. It's a window. And the camera on the other side is really the other side of the window. But when they make a show, there's like eight cameras, and they just keep hopping around trying to recreate movies, basically. I mean, long shots, close-ups. It's a live version of a movie. And I just thought, maybe there should just be one camera. Like, would that be better? Would that be better for the performers if they just understood the deal? And had more like proximity kind of to direct themselves with the camera rather than a director telling them what to do. So I came up with this idea, which was the TV Wheel, which was a camera in the middle of a 32-foot turntable with sets all around it. And so, and it did what the thing that I was most interested in, which is like in camera tricks and
forced perspective.
And to try to do, I just felt like, I mean, I guess at the time I was comparing it to SNL, and I just didn't feel like there was enough visual candy, enough like nice things to look at, and enough visual surprises. So, and I felt like we did that good on really well on Mystery Science Theater. And so I kind of wanted to take that and make a much more visual sketch show. So that's kind of what it was. And again, probably just, I think I felt obliged since I created Mystery Science Theater that I felt like, oh, this is my job now is to create these new comedic art forms. So here's another one. This one's with a wheel and a camera.
Right.
And it rotates around.
And it was one shot.
Like, yeah, it was pretty much one shot. Yeah. I mean, we did some occasionally. When we went out of it, you'd go to an exterior shot to kind of indicate what was going on.
Because did you originally make it for HBO?
Well, right, it was HBO, and I made it to just do it in one shot. And so the problem was when they put it on Comedy Channel, or Comedy Central, they had to cut it up, and so it kind of lost. I felt it lost a lot of its like impact.
Yeah.
But it holds up really well. It feels really live.
It's like putting putting commercials in the Goodfellas scene where they go into the kitchen, cut the commercial, then back, and then they go back and sit down.
That's such a good analogy. Because really seriously, we did this entire show. We had 29 minutes and 30 seconds to do it. We did it in 29 minutes and 29 seconds.
Oh my gosh.
All the set changes. Everything's live. The audience is live. The music is live. We just did it in one take, and you're exactly right. They just said, oh, yeah, we have to cut the tail and the head off this because we got to put commercials in. So I tried to salvage it by doing bumpers, but again, it was just like kind of a patch job.
Yeah.
So anyway, at CineFamily, on Monday, I'm going to get to talk about it and kind of, show slides from the development of it and how we figured everything out, how we did it.
That's fantastic. Yeah,
cool. I know. So I'm that successful that I can come back and discuss my failed project.
But, there are some things that maybe TV just wasn't ready for that kind of a thing yet, or audiences. I mean, it is, I think that's a perfect show for the web because the right audience will find it. And on television is just so broad that the second someone doesn't get something, like, what is this shit? They just don't, they're confused. And then they're not in it.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point. And, it's funny. I met a guy who, works in, he was the 3D guy at Sony, and he's like got his own company now. And he talked to me about TV Wheel. He said, that would like work so good in 3D because the lens isn't tromboning at all. Like you're not changing. It's the same deal. It's consistent.
Oh.
So I thought that was like a really great note, and it's kind of true. It's like, but yeah. And you're right about TV in general where it was really one or two people's decision to say, "Oh, we don't want to buy this as a series, or we're not going to put it on. We're just going to run it on Comedy Channel."
Yeah. So then, what did you do? Because you live in Minnesota now, right?
I live in Pennsylvania.
Oh, you live in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Close.
You want to know what I do now?
Yeah.
Because you're not going to believe it.
What?
I do Cinematic Titanic. No.
Wait, what is Cinematic Titanic? Well, it's where we take you. What?
Yes. It's crazy. I got this gig. I'm the creative lead for media for an aerospace company called Kinet.
What?
Yeah. And this guy, Guido Fetta, has invented.
That's not a real name.
It's very racist, Joel.
I just said Guido Fetta really loud.
So he's an Italian Greek?
No, he's a beautiful Italian man, about this tall.
But his last name's Fetta.
You're going to say it's Super
Mario. That's a Greek
Mario.
Cheese.
It's not Super Mario.
Does he come to work in red suspender, like a red jumpsuit?
He's got a big hat and a mustache.
It's a me, Guido.
What's that?
It's a me, Guido.
I just invented a new form of space transport.
Now,
but I gotta tell you,
he's adorable. Look at his blunder.
Space transport to save the princess. No, we're not gonna save the princess.
So I encourage you to go to kanae.com.
What's that spelling?
kanae.com.
Okay.
And what it is it's amazing. It's a satellite engine that doesn't use reaction mass, meaning it doesn't burn fuel. It uses technology from particle accelerators to keep satellites up in their geosynchronous orbit. So, yeah, you're laughing, right?
I'm not laughing. I'm not laughing. I'll tell you what I'm doing is it's the funny part to me is how that technology conceivably could have driven the satellite of love. Like, just thinking that that's how it all came back around. Like, that you did this show about being on a satellite, and now you work on satellite a company that builds satellite propulsion.
Are those also shaped kind of like a scrotum?
No, the satellite of love was not a penis. I have said this to you a million times, and
I know it wasn't conceived that way. But if you just look at half of it.
You must have a weird cock.
Yes, no.
That's what it's like.
No, but my balls look like a satellite.
You know the story of why it looks like that, right? Why it looks like a bone? The satellite.
A dog bone?
Yeah. Do you know why? This is so, like, I love this so much. This is Trace's idea. We are getting together and, like, going, okay, well, we know we want geodesic domes to be part of the ship because that's just practical. It's good design. We were both into Buckminster Fuller. Mm-hmm. And he comes in the next day, and he shows me a Nyla bone, and he holds it up to me, and he goes, this is what the satellite of love is going to look like. And I go, why? And he goes, it's like from that shot in 2001 when the early man throws the bone up into the air, and then he does the cut, and there's that spaceship. So he morphed those two frames together to make a satellite or a spaceship that looked like a bone.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God.
So that's that moment. And I just thought, you can do whatever you want with me now. if you keep saying stuff like that, I'll do whatever you say.
So you handle their media?
Yeah, Guido's got three. Yes, he can't stop laughing. Sorry. Yeah, he's got three videos up there that I produced that kind of explain the technology, and I helped him name. It's called the Q Drive. The engine is actually called the Q Drive. So I helped him do that. I got him together, you know, with designers, the guys from House Industries. If you know those guys, they did they did the design stuff, the font and the logos and a lot of the design stuff on the website. But it's really fun, and it's really, like, great to do something that's real rather than, like, making up stuff and having to talk other people into it. I mean, you still do. I mean, he just sent it up for the Physics Journal Review. And this is really provocative, what he's suggesting, the way it works. He's got a working prototype, and the Physics Journal Review just, it's kind of like pitching a TV show, because what they did was they're kind of afraid of it because it's kind of crazy, because he's basically saying, well, this engine can run off a solar panel and it can keep a satellite in its orbit indefinitely. And right now, satellites, they burn rocket fuel, and they're only good for like 10 or 15 years, and then they're basically disposed of, you know. And so he's saying, no, you just put this up once and it takes care of itself, and you can do that. And they're kind of like hedging their bets. So one guy from the Physics Journal Review said, okay, you can publish this. I believe it's real. The other guy said, no, you can't. So in the event it works, you know, in the event it works, he's demonstrated that it works. But in the event it takes off and it's like becomes an industry, they're covered. Like, hey, we said it worked and we said it didn't work. So it's cool, you know. But it is.
Was that Heisenberg Magazine?
That part of it. No, it's the Physics Journal Review.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Close. Quantum Physics Review. It works and it doesn't work.
Yeah, so we're covered in case they got burnt by the cold fusion thing. Oh, so being really careful now. But anyway, so that's my job. I mean, you know, part-time when I'm not doing Cinematic Titanic.
That's a pretty great life. It's going around and getting to do the thing you love, but then also working to help advance technology.
It's great. And when you look at the Curiosity footage, it's kind of like feeling like all the rich kids in the high school and their parents are celebrating how great they are, but we've got something way better, but nobody knows about it yet. That's kind of how it feels.
Well, now they will. With Kine, is there anything for people to do to help or get involved, or is there a Twitter account? Like, what can people?
Yeah, go to
or
the
do we
website.
Just observe?
I think I'm trying to think what they can do.
Buy more feta.
Yeah, Guido Fetta. Just keep saying that to each other. That's all you need to do.
Sounds like a Dick Tracy villain.
I'm going to tell him that.
Please don't.
No, no.
Please. Oh, please.
Please. Please don't. I was just kidding.
Chris, please don't.
So that people can go to the website at Kanae.com.
Yeah, Kanae.com. I don't know what else they can do other than...
Believe.
Believe. Please believe. If you could just believe in this one last thing that I'm offering.
I would just Joel.
Joel will fly into your bedroom through the open window and take you to an island.
Okay.
Very well.
Okay, I believe. I believe. Is it true, Dana Gould told us that you shared, I think, like a workspace with Husker Du? When you were
in St. Paul, I had a warehouse space that was the warehouse from the Husker Du album, The Warehouse.
Wow.
So yeah, I'd see him around, walk in the halls and stuff. And at the other warehouse was where I actually met Jim Mallon. The Colonial Warehouse was where the Replacements practiced.
Really?
So yeah, it was all happening.
Oh, that's crazy.
It was all there.
Did you get to know them as well? And were they fans of the show at all?
I got to know Chris Mars, who's a really cool guy, and hung out with him a few times. He's like a fine artist now. And he does really cool paintings. He's the guy who won't allow the reunion to happen. Like, the Replacements want to get back together. Tommy and Paul want to get back together, but...
I always figured it would be Tommy that wouldn't want
to... Nope. They want it to happen, but Chris Mars is saying, no, I'm happy. Pictures. It must have been pretty awful for him. I don't know, but...
Well, I wonder if sometimes, you know, like... Janet had this thing where when we were... Obviously, she probably still has it. I don't know why I would say. When we were together, she had this thing. But she had this very interesting thing that kind of I absorbed emotionally, which is if we were driving somewhere... Even if we got like 5 blocks from home and we forgot something at home, she wouldn't want to go home because she hated backtracking.
Oh, I hate backtracking.
Hated going back the same way. A lot of times you could get around it if you're like, okay, we'll take another way so it doesn't feel like backtracking. And I think in a larger sense, philosophically, spiritually, whatever, she sort of had that just sort of general philosophy. And I think there are people who have that in life. They're like, I already did that and I just don't. I just can't go through those motions again. I need to just be having new experiences and seeing new things.
Yeah, I think a switch goes off where you just go, I'm all done.
Even though the fans are like, how can you not? You know, like, yeah, I know, but I'm the guy who has to make it.
I would like to see the Replacements get back together. I'd go to that.
Yeah.
Definitely do that.
So Cinematic Titanic is Josh and you and
Frank Connor.
Frank was another one. Frank used to run this comedy room with Jeremy Kramer at the Complex Theater on Santa Monica called Frank's Chop House.
Oh yeah.
And like two people a week would show up to it, but it was right around when I first started really doing stand up pretty heavily, and like I don't know, I want to say like 98 maybe, 99, somewhere around there. And you'd go and it was so much fun, but there would like maybe two people would show up, but you would still get up and fucking
Him and Pepitone, Eddie Pepitone had a show at the Fate Gallery, where there was just two old TVs on the stage. And then they were up in the, upper second floor with little cameras, like right in front of them, like, you know, with night vision. And then, so like they would be talking to each other on stage on these weird TVs, and then they would introduce a comic, and then the TVs would go black.
Now Frank does Cartoon Dump.
Yeah,
which is a great show that I the Steve Allen.
Yeah,
if you guys haven't seen it,
he's one of the best joke writers.
How are we doing? Is it? I'm getting the feeling from you. It's time to wind up.
It's right? About an hour, actually. Yeah. We're right about an hour. But please, you're not getting that from me. I'll talk to you for another hour. But I'm just starting to. I get very sensitive about my guests on the show.
I'm good. I think it's going well, and I was worried.
How's the show been so far?
I think it's going good, and I was worried because it's been a long day. It's like flying from the East Coast. And I had a meeting already, and I forget how bad the traffic is.
Check out Hollywood over here.
Right?
Traffic, meetings.
You've changed,
guy,
man.
This guy,
huh?
Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, though, about Frank and his stand-up. He's so, that's where we kind of found everybody, was in the Minneapolis comedy scene. And it was like, you know, Josh brought me to see Mike. And the thing about Mike was he was like really amusing himself. There's like this kind of comic that is having a good time and doesn't need the audience.
Norm Macdonald.
Yeah, it doesn't need the audience to laugh or not. And that's what made me like him so much, because he was like, you could see a lot of comics are needy. They got to get, a comic is so dependent on the audience laughing.
Yeah.
And when you see somebody who doesn't do that, that's like knows they're funny and they're amusing the right people in the room. And I think Frank's that same way. He like thrives on the odds being against him. Like if two people are in the room, he'd go in there and he'd make you laugh really hard. And the funny part would be that they may or may not be laughing, you know. So it was really weird that way, but that's kind of how we found. It wasn't, you know, necessarily like, wow, they did a smoking 45-minute set.
Right.
It was more like everybody was at open stages and you just kind of like, oh, I like them. They seem nice and funny and they're interesting, you know.
Wow. That's cool. Well, I want to come to the show. I mean, the unfortunate thing is that we can't post the show before Sunday because people don't listen. We don't.
And I spent all this time hyping the show.
But here's what we'll do, though.
We can post it Monday, though. Monday morning.
Here's what we'll do. We will promote it as much as possible through, you know, Twitter and the website.
Post it onto the site.
Yeah, post it on the site. And so we'll let people know about the show Sunday night.
Oh, that's good.
Just so you don't feel like you've just wasted an hour.
But I don't, you know, I mean, how much time to actually spend promoting the cinematic Titanic show?
3.5 minutes, maybe.
You were going to say 3.5 hours. Yeah.
Even before you went into it, you're like, I guess I got to say that we're doing the cinematic Titanic.
Are you doing me?
Come on.
Oh, very awkward.
He was. Jonah, you fucked up.
Super sleepy.
I was. That's just me. I was trying to set the tone.
Yeah. No, Jonah, you were totally like, so I'm Joel now. Hey, everyone. You did stretched out where it was really awkward.
No, I did none of that.
Kind of disrespectful.
Joel busted you right on the show.
I mean, Jonah, you literally just mocked one of your idols to his fucking face.
I did not try to do the voice.
Jonah tried to get all buddy-buddy with Joel on the show by riffing on him in front of everybody. This is my favorite thing ever.
How you said it.
Yeah, I'm your new best friend, Jonah. You and I are going into the city tonight.
He's going to play that on his phone now. It's going to be his ringtone, that audio clip.
You're doing me to me.
This fucking sucks.
I never see Jonah get flustered. It's fucking awesome.
I'm trying to do your voice.
I'm just teasing.
I know.
It's so easy to do my voice, so I just don't begrudge anyone.
That is a golden moment. That is a golden moment. It's rare.
Most of the time.
Rare that that happens.
You said it.
It's awesome. You just got an achievement, Joel. If an achievement badge could come up on your Xbox home screen.
That would be great.
Thank you. So are you on the Twitter as well? Or do you stay away from the show to me? No.
All right. I'm not, but I'd love to be shown how to do it.
Sure.
If you want to show me.
I'll show you. It's good to see you, and I really, you know, honestly, just to get a little sappy, your contribution has rippled far and wide to a generation of young comics who, or at least for me and all the people that I know, of just like, you know, again, comedy can be smart, comedy can, you know, you don't have to go as broad as possible, and it can really, you really can make stuff that you appreciate and amuses yourself.
Well, I accept your compliment, Chris.
Thank you.
And now I'd like to say something nice about you and Matt and Jonah. And I've had a great time. I'm just kidding. I don't want to make fun of it. I really appreciate it. And it's slightly it's peculiar because it's slightly unreal to hear that from people, but I really appreciate it. And it's really great.
No, that's true. I think two-thirds of us own a Tom Servo. You have one? I have one.
Yeah, I have one.
Yeah,
I don't have a Tom Servo, but I have a
Tom Servo.
I have a picture of me making out with a Tom Servo, which I tweeted to Kevin, and I was like, This is really awkward. Because I'm literally like, you can see my tongue in its little beak.
Yeah.
Right. Have you seen the beak. Manos video game?
No.
I'll show it to you. It's on. It's available for the phone.
We made like a 16-bit Manos game.
Yeah, it's and it's I think it's 8-bit, and it on the second 16. Level there's a Tom Servo in the background.
Now, didn't they remaster?
They're still trying to raise money to remaster it. And yeah, I think Rift Tracks just did like one of their like you know
right
projected stuff. Or
as we wrap up. A lot of time, you know, at the end of every episode, we tell everyone to enjoy their burrito. So will Jonah do Joel's voice? I'm kidding. Put him on the spot.
I'll just end up.
Jonah felt so comfortable with me.
I didn't.
He felt like he could do me in front of me. And then I stopped him.
I didn't. All right.
Wait a minute.
First off,
you're in the room with me. I'm not gone yet.
This is just.
Please.
All right. I'll let you know. I haven't ever felt comfortable this entire time. And, I wasn't trying to do your voice.
Oh, greatest thing ever.
I know. But no.
They do it as my voice.
I don't want to. Because then I'm bad on the spot. I'll end up sounding like Rodney on the Rock or something.
Hey, the Vandals are playing.
He has, I think, the 3 a.m. to 6 a.m.
Oh, Joel,
slot.
He cannot be killed by conventional means.
Yeah.
He is not of this world.
No.
Wow, it's amazing.
The only thing
the only thing that can bring him down is moisture to his mouth.
No, the only thing
that's what he does not have.
Rodney would be one of those guys.
The only thing that could take him down is a female-fronted rock group.
Rodney is one of those guys that if he were more famous would have appeared at the Men in Black headquarters on their wall of like, these are famous people who are aliens, you know, like.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, like Lady Gaga, Rodney Bingenheimer.
Yeah, the Mayor of Sunset Strip is quite an interesting documentary.
I saw that and it was shocking that like he's friends with Bowie. That just seems so weird.
Yeah, it's like all these insanely huge rock stars just know him. Rodney. But that's just where he lives with. He just lives in a small apartment.
There were a couple of PBS documentaries just about old LA, like LA in the 60s and the 70s or whatever. And he was always one of the talking heads.
He's been there. Like, and now he's still, you see him like going to Amoeba, going through the records.
Yeah.
I think he goes to this, at least he did when I worked at K Rock. He would go to the same Denny's every, it was like the same breakfast, the same day in, day out, you know, creature of habit. Yeah. Oh. Well, Rodney's not here to defend himself.
Enjoy your burrito, everybody.
Is he just not going to do it, Jonah?
No. Jonah doesn't have to do it.
I'll do Jonah doing me. Enjoy your burrito, everybody.
It didn't sound like that.
Snorted. Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
I feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
Is win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges that will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly crying.
Lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell have I got myself into?
The GOAT, premiering on Freevee and Prime Video on May 9th.